Frank Chadwick. What is the exact title of this? The Space 1889, Real Steampunk, The Space 1889 Story. I don't know that Space 1889 is any more real in steampunk than anything else, but it's older than most of this stuff. And so, and I suppose for a subject matter dealing with classic science fiction, older is better. we started, those of you probably, everybody's familiar with Space 1889, at least in general terms?
Yeah.
You're not? Okay. It was a role-playing, it started off as a board game. The original game in the Space 1889 series was a board game called Sky Galleons of Mars, which was about British aerial gunboats and Martian wooden cloud ships fighting in the skies over Mars. Set in 1889 in a fictional alternate history of where Victorian science fiction stuff actually works. And then it was followed immediately by the role-playing game, Space 1889, which came out in 1988, I believe, or 89. I think the board game was in 88, maybe the role-playing game was in 89.
There's a Savage Worlds module.
Yes, there is.
I looked at that.
Yeah, and that just came out last year. That was under license from me, and they did a nice job. They did a nice job with it. So, bring it up today with the Savage Worlds. There was a whole bunch of background and role playing games and stuff like this. Soldier's Companion. It was the miniatures rules for it. I love that cover.
It is very nice.
Yes. Yeah, so for those of you who know a little bit about historical miniature gamers,
yep.
I'm here. Yes, yes. The artist for that cover is Rich Hasenauer. Who did originally Königskrieg, and then he did
Fire and Fury.
Fire and Fury. He's the designer of Fire and Fury, but he's also a pretty good painter. He didn't do a lot of painting, but he did a bunch of paint. The only cover paintings that I know of in the hobby that he did is he did a bunch for Space 1889. He did that one. He did Caravans of Mars. I think he did one or two others. I love that painting. I love that painting with him. And the big steam tank in the background, as you get closer, you kind of see it.
What are these rules like? Are they similar to any other?
They're much like they're basically colonial rules with aerial flyers and weird stuff and German armored tripods and steam tanks. You know, basically take colonial rules and add a bunch of science fiction stuff to them.
Low level, high.
The basic unit was a squad of about 10 guys, but that was a half platoon, and then two of those made a company, and two of those made a battalion. So you could do larger actions, but it was all kind of bathtub, the representative stuff. So yes, a squad is a squad, but there's not many squads in a battalion. And 10 figures was like a troop of cavalry, and two of those made a squadron, and two of those made a regiment. So about 40 figures was a whole regiment of cavalry.
What would be a typical miniature scale for you to play that at?
20. It was almost all played with 25s. Right now, and there's still a lot of 25s available. Right now, we are the Highlander Studios is doing a line of 15s. We've been doing sculpts on. And by the way, for those of you who don't know about it. I have a blog that I've been doing for about 6 months on Space 1889 called Frank Chadwick's Space 1889. You know, it's really hard to remember. But you might want to check that out because we've got a bunch of the master sculpts from Highlander Studios of the upcoming Space 1889 miniatures line, which is 15s. And I mean, they are spectacular. The guy that's doing the sculpts for Highlander, who owns Highlander Studios, you look at these, I've had people look at them and go, yeah, those are pretty nice, you know. And then they realize they're 15s and not 28s, okay? And then they say, wow, because they look like 28s. I mean, they're really, I mean, he's got one figure where he's got some American adventurers, and it's a guy, and he's, You know, he's standing there and he's got a kind of a ray gunny looking pistol here and another pistol here, and he's got buckskins, you know, with the fringe. He's got kind of a longish beard. It looks like, and I said, he looks like Wild Bill Hickok with ray guns, you know. But he's got all this facial detail and he's got character in his face and beard and all the individual fringe, and you look at it and you'd swear it's a 28, but you're looking at a 15. I mean, it's really, really nice stuff. If you want to take, and that's got a lot of updates on what's going on with Space 1889. So I'll tell you what's happening right now with Space 1889. The big thing is that, and I haven't gone online in the last 2 or 3 days, so the first book may actually be out. But about 8 months ago, I was contacted by a publishing house called Untreed Reads, which is the largest e-publishing house, exclusively e-publishing house out there. And they wanted to do a licensed series of books set in the Space 1889 world. Well, they had a series editor who would line up the authors, and they were starting off with a season of 6 books that would be that follow the same character, and all these would follow the same set of characters, but basically it's 6 stories in sequence that kind of each have their own adventure but have an overall story arc as well. And I said, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. I'd like to do that. So we signed the license with them. And then the fellow who is the editor of the series is Andy Frankham Allen, who is the author of the 4th of the Noise Monster audio adventures. Now, some of you may not have known that, but about 6 or 7 years ago, a company in England called Noise Monster, the people in it had done a bunch of the Doctor Who audio adventures. They did really nice audio adventures for Doctor Who. I licensed them to do a series of audio adventures for Space 1889, and there were 4 Space 1889 audio adventures done on CD, and they did a great job. I mean, it was all really good voice talent, professional actors who did a lot of the Doctor Who stuff, great sound effects and really good music, and I mean, they really did a great job of the night. And I mean, you can get this stuff now. Since it's old, I can get it pretty inexpensively. But I highly, if you haven't tried it, you might want to pick one of those up because they're really neat. And you'll find it up buying all 4 of them because you like them a lot. But anyway, the 4th one was called The Lunar Inheritance. And that was co-written by 2 guys. One of them was Andy Frankham Allen. And he kind of got the Space 1889 bug writing this. So he's the guy that actually went to Untreed Reads and said, you contact this guy. I'll put together the authors. We'll get together, put this series of stories together, get the license from them. So we did that. And so they've been working on the books ever since. It's 6, and it's 5 novellas, and then the 6th book is a full-length novel. And the first one is releasing, like, right now. It was supposed to release in August. We had some snags with the cover art. So it ended up being the very end of August, early September. The second book is coming out in September. The 3rd and 4th books are coming out in October. The 5th book comes out in November. And then the 6th book, which wraps up the first season, comes out in December, if all goes according to plan. And I at this point, I think that there's no reason for it not to, unless we have a problem with one of the manuscripts. But, I mean, almost all the manuscripts are in. However, so anyway, that's Untreed Reads, and it's called Space 1889 and Beyond. And you can just do a Google search for Untreed Reads. The price is, maybe these are ebooks, so the novella price is $2.99 per book, which is not a bad price. The full-length book, the last book in the series, is $4.99. So is that right? There's it 2, 3 times 5 is 15, and 5 is, yeah, so it's, if you bought the whole series of 6 books, it's $20 for the whole series. And like I said, the first one of those, which is called Journey to the Heart of Luna, which picks up, those of you who remember Space 1889, remember that introductory adventure in the thing called On Gossamer Wings, which is set in Luna. And then the 4th of the Noise Monster audio dramas kind of carried that story a little further, and that was called The Lunar Inheritance. And now the first of these books is called Journey to the Heart of Luna, and one of the main characters, who is one of the 2 main characters recurring throughout the series, is Annabelle Somerset, who is the you know, kind of the back on heroine, who's kind of the motivating heroine in the adventure in the original role-playing game for On Gossamer Wings. She's also an important character in the Journey to the Heart of Lunathan, and now she's becoming a central character, one of the two main characters in this whole story arc that Untreated Reed is doing. So that's very cool. You know, that's very cool. Now, for me personally, what made it even cooler was I just finished about 6 to 8 months ago, I finished a novel which I'm still shopping called The Forever Engine, which is a novel set in the Space 1889 universe. And so when the license came through from Untreated Reads, I sent that manuscript to Andy, and I said, "There's a lot about the background. There's some changes and the additional developments in the background of Space 1889 that you ought to know about. Here's the novel manuscript that's got all the background stuff in it." So in May of this year, Andy contacted me, and he said, "You know, yeah, I read the manuscript. It's real nice. The author of the fifth book in the series had to drop out because of a scheduling conflict. Do you want to write the fifth book? It's set on Mars." Said, "Hell yes, I do." So, and it was it was a real wild ride because I started in the end of May, and I turned it in the 1st of August. Yeah, so basically in 60 days, I wrote a 40,000-word novella. And most of it was written in the second month because the first month was mostly plotting and outlining and looking at the ceiling and stuff like that. And then really started writing hard in July. And I was gone two trips in July, so I only had about 20 writing days in July. And so in those 20 writing days, I averaged 2,000 words a day, which for me is very good. And I know guys who are absolutely crazy who write 3,000 words a day every day of their life. One guy I know, he was at a writer's conference I was at, and he was saying, I had events all day yesterday, then I was up in the bar socializing and networking with people until 1 o'clock in the morning, and then I went to the room and wrote my 3,000 words. And he says, so I'm basically living on caffeine and adrenaline at this point. He's a better man than I am, you know, I can't do that. But I actually average about 2,000 words a day for those 20-some writing days in July, and I'm real happy with what I came up with, and I'm real happy with, this is the only other story set on Mars in the series. The first story is set on Luna. The second story is set on Venus. The third story is set on Mercury. The fourth story is set on an orbit, on a deep space heliograph station. And then from that they end up on Mars in the fifth book, and the sixth book is actually back on Luna, which wraps up this whole first season story arc. And there are already plans afoot for the second season. I got to do a bunch of stuff on Mars that I had a lot of fun with. I've always been preaching, you've got to respect the material. You've got to respect the material. But that doesn't mean that you can't have some fun with it. So without spoiling anything, I will give you one example of kind of the fun I had. Those of you who are familiar with the Space 1889 universe know that Gashants, the mounts that are used, are basically bipedal. They look kind of, they're lizard-like, but they're kind of, they have the gait and of ostriches. And their front legs are just atrophied stumps. That's certainly the way the game explains it. And it explains it through the medium of Conklin's Atlas of the World and the Handbook of Useful Information, which is the Bible, not only in the game, but also in the world. It represents the real book in the world. So in the course of this adventure, at one point, they're hooked up with a caravan, and it's got a caravan guard mounted on Gashants, and these two British people, the British and American, the British fellow and the American woman, who've never really been, either have ever been to Mars before, but he British fellow that here has his conference, you know, and he's beating up on all this stuff. In the course of this, they get attacked by steppe marshals, the steppe nomads, who are also Maharaja Shants, and he almost gets ridden down. And he gets set up in a fight and everything. And at the end of it all, he says to his kind of their Martian mentor, who's been taking them through all this, it's interesting that not only the hill Martians seem very much more ferocious than the canal Martians, but they ride a more primitive version of the Gashant that is obviously not as it hasn't atrophied because it's got actually these grasping talons grasping hands with pretty frightening talons on them, you know. And this guy says, it's not a different species. The canal Martians just cut the front hands off of their Gashants when they're young to make them more easy to manage. He said, really? Boy, Conklin's got that wrong, didn't he? So, there's a number of things in Conklin's Atlas of the World that, as you're going to find out over the course of time, are actually what the fellows who wrote it thought it was like. Another thing that you'll get into is how sky galleons work. Because someone rightly pointed out that if you've just got a ship that's floating in the air, sails don't really do you any good. You know, a big sail or a little sail, and basically the ship's going to drift downwind at the speed of the wind. Because you can't steer. There's no friction. There's nothing for a centerboard or a rudder or anything else to bite against if you're just up in the air. So sail, no sail, you're going to drift downwind in the direction of the wind at the speed of the wind, period. Well, that's true. That's true. So they discover how cloud ships work, and it works. And I won't even tell you what it is, but I spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, how would you make that work? And how do you explain the fact that the game originally explains it in terms of kind of like wind jammers in the sky? Well, that's how it's drawn in the Strand magazine. So when he gets to it, he says, this doesn't look exactly like the illustrations in the Strand make it look, does it? It turns out that the guys drawing them haven't actually ever seen one. You know, they're just imagining what it probably looks like. So, the explanation of how it works is really cool. I really enjoyed it coming up with how the things really work, and it does make sense. So that's kind of that's the big thing in the e-publishing world and in fiction that's happening with Space 1889. The other thing that's going on with it is I'm just finishing up a set of miniatures rules called Mars Needs Steam, which is primarily Space 1889, but really it can be used for any sort of steampunk because it's got a really nice equipment generation section in this. You can generate the science fiction weapons, you can generate aerial vehicles, land vehicles, walkers, land dreadnoughts, all this stuff. And the reason that the design system, I think, works well for this is that the game uses a point-based system for determining your forces. And instead of trying to come up with a scientific rationale for how you design these things, instead the design system lets you specify what the characteristics are and then tell you what the points for that are in the game. So you know, we really don't care how you... Then you can put in a description on it if you want to. This weapon has... It's highly accurate, it's got long range, it uses a lot of power, so you have to recharge it every turn, which means it's got a reload, it takes a turn to reload. It's very easy to hit, it has no effect on vehicles, and it doesn't really kill people, but it has a real big morale effect or stunning effect. You know, all those things have characteristics in terms of the points they cost or get back to you in the game. Now, what is that? Oh, it's a Van de Graaff ray, you know, it's static electricity, or whatever you want to describe it. I mean, but you can take a weapon and basically if you can identify the game characteristics of it, and then there's a point cost for each of those characteristics, you end up with, this is what the thing costs in the game, and now you can go ahead and describe it. So that's why I think it's pretty easy. And so if you want to do War of the Worlds, okay, designed a tripod, it's got a ray, it's got a heat ray or a ray gun that has a very destructive effect. You can do all sorts of stuff like that. And so I can think you can use it for pretty much any genre. It is designed, however, primarily for the Space 1889 genre. And the way it's designed to play is what I call a non-refereed adventure game. So the way it works is, in the most basic version, two players. And those two players will, first off, start off by picking a nationality. And the nationality will determine what sort of personalities and leaders they can get. And the nationalities are Britain, France, Germany, Belgium, Russia, Japan, the United States of America, the Confederate States of America, a Martian state, and the anarchists. So those kind of who you can pick from. And then the sorts of leaders that you can have, you've got a bunch of military leaders, but you've also a mechanic, aerial mechanic, inventor, naturalist, geologist, archaeologist, explorer, hunter, local scout, industrialist, spy, gun runner, revolutionary, shaman, and potentate. And of course, not all of these are available to all the nationalities. Only the Martians get potentates. And I think only the Martians get shaman. Only the Americans, the USA, the Confederate States of America, and the anarchists get gun runners. So there's some variation in terms of what you can get. And then each of those personalities give you the ability to buy certain units. If you want, if the military personalities give you regular military units. A mechanic gives you the ability to buy a vehicle. So you can buy one of the standard steam tanks or whatever that's described in the game. An inventor gets you the ability to just design your own from the back of the book. Design your own, any sort of exotic vehicle or weapon you want to do. An aerial mechanic gets you a flying vehicle. So in addition to some different things. So a gunner gets you an artillery unit. So you pick your personalities that you want. And some of these guys also have talents, skills. Like an archaeologist has, an archaeologist, as you would expect, has artifact as a skill. Explorers have animal knowledge and native customs. Then you get your force. You got some units, you got some personalities, some skills, and then you set up the terrain and you put a bunch of objectives out. They're just objective markers. And when you get to those, you turn a card. And there's a deck of cards with the game. You turn a card, and that tells you what you encounter there. And it can be a bunch of natives. It can be an exotic animal. And if you've got someone with animal skill, it's easier to sneak up on the animals. And if you don't have anybody, that's easier for the animals to surprise you. If you've got native talent, it's easier to get them to come along with you. And some of the things are treasures, artifacts, jewels, whatever. So if you've got a geologist, you get more points for that. So the objective of the game is to go out on this table, get these random things, and also beat up on the other guy. But you also get points for, it's also just a miniatures war game. So you're kind of the big objective is taking objectives, but you have to do it by force, and that's the purpose of the military units. But in addition to that, you've got all this random stuff happening that as you get to these. So it could be a cache of jewels, or it could be a whole bunch of really terrible animals that are supposed to, that you've got to start dealing with them. And, the other guy can be snickering while you're getting overrun by that. And the deck's set up for Mars. It'll be pretty easy to do decks for other environments, including darkest Africa on Earth, or the Venusian jungles. So it's pretty easy to expand it out to that. But that's how it works. I'm pretty happy with it. I'll tell you the genesis for the way we did it was I spent a lot of time looking at pulp games at conventions, and I really like the idea of pulp games, but when you looked at the rules, without missing anybody in any game, and I'm not trying to run down anybody else's rules, but I'm just, as a player, as I looked at them, they didn't really tell you how to do a pulp game. They told you how guns worked. You know? They told you a lot of mechanics, But you kind of had to make the game up yourself. And after you've done one or two scenarios, it gets pretty hard for people to keep coming up with situations for this sort of pulp adventure game. And so what I spent a lot of time doing with a couple other people I work with is thinking about how in a game you actually can make that event, that kind of exciting, unexpected, chaotic adventure stuff happen without having to have a genius referee always there making the stuff up for you. And so that's what we're trying to do. And I think we'll see what you think when it comes out. But I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's a pretty cool idea.
What's the scale of that? The squads?
A unit's about 10. It's 10 men.
Okay.
And you'll have, depending on how many points you want, you'll have 4 or 5 units on in a player's command.
Okay.
And it's set. The basic game is set up for 2-player. It's very easy to expand it to multiplayer. It takes a little bit of jimmying because you don't want just to be multiplayers all on the same side. Ideally, you want all these people who are potentially adversaries with everybody else and can make some alliances, but that takes some working in terms of the turn sequence. But it's not an insurmountable problem. Yeah.
Are the leader characters represented as a?
Yes, they're miniatures too.
So you can kill someone's naturalist.
Yes, you can. Okay. Yeah. And one of the characters is a spy. That's one of the characters. And the spy, at some point during the game, gets to pick a figure on the other side, and that figure comes up. It's basically your figure to run now. Basically, a traitor in the ranks on the other. It can't be a personality, but you know, one of the soldiers or something. So at an awkward moment, the machine gunner can turn the machine gun on his own force or something. So the spy is a pretty powerful character. So that's kind of what my outline of stuff to start talking about. And at this point, let's I'll do a questions and answer, and we'll go wherever you want to go on steampunk. Yeah.
I had a question about the point by the technology system you're talking about for the game. From a game design standpoint, you sit down with a calculator and just crunch that stuff out, or is it more of a you get stuff on a table and start playing around and see what works and what doesn't?
We're coming out this like in about a month with a tactical World War II game called Men Under Fire, and in the course of doing Men Under Fire, we've spent a lot of time working out a point system, and we ended up with a point system that we kind of figured out. In that game system, what it really meant, what the chances of survival were by increasing things like your rate of fire by 1 or your range by a certain amount. And so Mars Needs Steam is based on a simplified version of that system, but we took that point system, which we spent a lot of time working on, and used that as the basis, because it already assigned values to all these characteristics like speed, armor, range, penetration, rate of fire. And it was pretty easy then to kind of just expand that a little bit with some other of the more exotic stuff we put in, because those are the main drivers in a war game. And we've got some exotic stuff too, like the weapon can cut through cover, you know, like if it's a ray gun or something. But that's pretty easy to figure out once you've got the hard stuff done, to say, okay, this guy is not going to be affected by cover. Well, how often is cover important? It's this much. It's going to increase the value of the weapon by about this much. So part of it is like a lot of table work and playing, and people putting together armies and saying, well, this guy isn't worth the points. You know, we're never going to buy this because he's not worth it. Okay, so he should be worth. He should be fewer points. And then just a little bit of by the pants, you know, polishing up. Okay, we're done.
How about things for big battles? Since I'm a big fan of Ollie and Bayonet, what about anything for like colonial period big battles or epic battles on?
I haven't started working on that because we'll just have to see how well this works for that. The basic mechanics here, although it's set up for a skirmish game, we've done like a weak battalion on a side in World War II, and this. Assuming each squad is a squad, but two of them are a platoon, and you know, two or three of them are a company. And if you scale that down, you can do some pretty good sized battles. The nice thing about these rules is they're very, very quick playing. They are not, you know, they're not rules that bog you down at all. They've got, that's not to say they're really, they're not completely simplistic, but they are, but they're very streamlined mechanically, and so you can play a pretty big battle in it. I mean, as you guys, what do you guys look for in steampunk? What is it? You're all here at a steampunk seminar. Why?
Not so much for steampunk, but to kind of hear what was going on with Space
1899. Oh, okay. Well, that's nice. That's very nice. But at Space 1889, I was saying on my blog, geez, about a month or two ago, that one of the satisfying things about Space 1889, and I don't mean this in a snarky way, although it's very difficult for it not to sound snarky, but I really don't. When it first came out, there was a group of folks in the hobby, of which I was one, you know, called the Academy of Game Critics. There was no formal membership; it was whoever showed up at the meeting at Origins, with usually drink in hand. And there were so many awards for games that the Academy of Game Critics began giving humorous, negative awards. None of the awards were positive. One of the awards I remember was the computer game most deserving to be stuck to a refrigerator with a magnet. And the year Space 1889 came out, it received from the Academy of Game Critics the Strontium 90 Award. For the game with the shortest half-life. Oh, yes. And it is a matter of some satisfaction that here we are over 20 years later, and this game is not only still around, but the genre has just exploded. You know, I mean, Space 1889 came up before the term steampunk had been invented.
Right.
And it was really one of the first real serious Victorian science fiction worlds where a whole bunch of world building had been put into the world. And I don't think there are many Victorian science fiction worlds that have as much world building behind them as the Space 1889 universe does. Even some of the fictional worlds. That is to say, the worlds commercial fiction. So, I mean, the fact that it's stuck around, the fact that it's, you know, getting more stuff coming out from it, there's the Red Sands, Savage Worlds thing, and there's a Kaufit in Germany looking at a role-playing. They've been working on a role-playing game. I don't think they're making much progress lately. I'm kind of poking them. Because they were talking about their role-playing game coming out this fall, and here it is, and haven't heard much from them lately, so I think they may have hit a little bit of a snag. But there is all the stuff from Untreat Reads, and I expect the Forever Engine will be. I just don't know who's going to publish it, but I'm pretty sure that's going to be out there probably within a year or 18 months. Just still trying to figure out who. The Forever Engine's, I had a lot of fun writing it. The Forever Engine is written from the point of view of a fellow from our time and place who, in a catastrophic accident at a large particle accelerator facility, ends up getting sent back to an alternate, a parallel universe, which is the Space 1889 universe. So it enabled me to write about the universe without having to assume and explain all the background, okay? Because instead of the protagonists knowing the background and living in it, it was a stranger in the world. Just, you know, it's somebody from our world, and I could write it with our sensibilities and our snarkiness sometimes, you know. And so this fellow was a three-tour veteran of Afghanistan, and at one point he's talking to a British officer who they're the two of them are off doing something. You end up the group of people who are off having to deal with the evil guy and the British major said, "Well, you were in the army. What did you do?" "So I was a translator." He says, "Oh, well, we usually hire a local Johnny to do that sort of thing for us." And he says, "Yeah, how'd that work out for you in Afghanistan?"
Yeah.
So it let me do a lot of sort of modern wisecracking about the world and in the world. And that a Victorian, of course, would never, seldom would. Although I think Victorians have a lot more sense of humor than people give them credit for. Can I see that copy of The Soldier's Companion? People have thought that I wrote this. People thought I wrote this, and this is actually directly taken from an actual piece of writing from the period. Here we go. This was reprinted from the Small Arms of the European Armies by W.W. Kimball in Scribner's Magazine, September of 1889. I did not write this. This is real stuff by a Victorian author. The conservatives asserted that with a magazine rifle, the man would fire away all his cartridges. It was explained that if the fire was made to tell, as it might, with the use of proper guns, it was not half a bad idea to fire away cartridges. That indeed, some people thought cartridges should be fired from guns, even if it soiled them with powder grime. Then it was objected that the bullet would make only a little hole in a man, and that it was much more satisfactory to literally let daylight through one's enemy than to puncture him in such a dilettante fashion. The argument was officially made in England to prove that all one really needed to do in battle, in the way of hitting an enemy, was to drop him in his tracks and make him stop being disagreeable with his shooting. And that if one could hit him hard enough, it was just as well to do it with a fast-flying small bullet as with a slow-going big one, while it was a much easier, surer, and simpler thing to do. Then the conservatives had their inning. The magazine was detachable, you see, and might be lost. So it was chained to the gun. The reason for chaining the gun and magazine together is excellent, but the idea is not thoroughly carried out. If it were, all the detachable parts should be chained together. The bayonet and cleaning rod by a couple of small chains, and the cartridges by 100 very little ones to the gun, the gun by a stouter one to the man, and the man by a good strong one to his comrades.
Any opportunities for video tie-ins, either movies or TV?
Well, we'll see. So far, we've been frustrated. There was a production outfit that optioned Space 1889 for film, and then worked for about 10 or 12 years trying to place it, and a couple of times got real close. One time, they had almost everything lined up for a film, and then the dot-com bubble burst. And all the financing guys lost all their money, and it got real panicky. And then the second time they were getting real close, and the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen came out and sucked all the oxygen out of the room for a while for steampunk film. It was so bad. And so there have been kind of some adventures that have kind of gotten in the way. I mean, they worked real hard. At first it was film, then they were looking at a TV series, then they were looking at some animation, and nothing ever quite worked out. And it got close a couple of times, but
the new Sherlock Holmes series you've got.
The new Sherlock Holmes series might do something. I would say that the two things that kind of sucked the oxygen out of the room on steampunk for a while were League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and The Wild Wild West.
Yes,
you know both of them had really good casts. You know, they should have been really great films, and they were, you know, kind of embarrassing to look at. Sherlock Holmes is a lot better.
Because they take it seriously. That's the
they respect the material.
Yes.
Respect the material.
Yes. John Carter is coming out next.
John Carter's coming out, and I'll tell you, if you've seen the trailers, trailers look really good. They look really good. So there are, there are a couple possibilities right now to kind of ignite the film interest in the genre again. But I tell you, the difference right now between now and when The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and Wild Wild West came out was when they came out, steampunk was kind of a little bit of a novelty thing that a couple people knew. You know, that today, it's really, really has reached critical mass. It is a self-sustaining chain reaction.
It's got a full head of steam.
What's that?
It's got a full head of steam.
Yes. So I think that even if these films that are coming out right now are failures, it's not gonna trip the genre up. But the genre has really, really got a lot of steam. I was at a writing conference last March, and a bunch of the editors who were there from publishing houses were saying that steampunk was the thing everybody was looking for, mm-hmm. and that nobody wanted to see another vampire book ever again in their life. They're just sick to death of vampire books. Anything but vampires, you know. But so steampunk is right now in a great, great position.
What about Lost World sort of things?
As
Lost World is kind of the 1889.
Dinosaurs.
I think the Sci-Fi Channel's probably killed that.
Yeah.
The Sci-Fi Channel hasn't, I don't think, killed anything because not enough people watch. And everybody, I mean, I watch, but I expect all the movies the Sci-Fi Channel does to be dreadful. And they do great series. I don't understand how they can do such good series and such awful films, mm-hmm. but
I guess in different departments,
you know, but they're both kind of under the same umbrella, and you'd think that they, you know, at some point somebody say, you know.
Why don't let the TV guys do the movies?
How's that?
Why don't we just have the TV guys do the movies?
Yeah. So I don't think the Sci-Fi Channel is wrecking. Everybody, I think, who watches movies on the Sci-Fi Channel knows exactly what they're going to get, which is crap. Yeah, unimaginative crap. I mean, the thing I hate most, I understand the idea of wanting to do films that are very, very low budget. There have been some very good low budget science fiction films done. My problem is when you've got a script that is literally, if two people sat down and brainstormed for 5 minutes, this is what they'd come up with. And then they'd stop and film it. I mean, that's what's, you know, the scripts are terrible. There's no interesting characterization. There's no interesting plot twists. There's, you know, it's A, B, C, D, the end. You know, it's all by the numbers. And there's no reason for that. I mean, writing is the cheapest part. Nobody pays writers anything. My God, it's easy to get, you know, writers to write stuff. But for some reason, you know, they, well, I don't understand. where they're getting these scripts or why they're filming them. And because they're just wasting a lot of money. Wasting a little money on it. But they're wasting a lot of airtime on it.
A lot of credibility, too.
And a lot of credibility. I mean, they can't. Yeah, I think pretty much everybody feels the same way about sci-fi. What I'm saying is not radical stuff. Ooh, the Sci-Fi Channel makes bad movies. If Frank thinks the Sci-Fi Channel makes bad movies, you heard? Yeah, who doesn't? You know, stop the presses. Huh?
The miniatures people, are they
going to
be doing airships?
Yes, they are. And that's one of the reasons that Rod's doing 15mm, is to make it easier to do vehicles and airships in resin.
I've never seen the board you had.
At one point. Yeah, we used to scratch build stuff out of balsa wood and foam, yeah. for 28mm stuff. But since he's doing it in 15s, it's much easier for him to actually do some of the smaller ships in resin. And some tanks.
What is it? The Aeronef and the iron, the land ironclads. What are those? 1/1200 scale or something like that.
That's from somebody else.
Yeah,
the Soviet stuff. Is that
Yeah, the flying ships and things like that, and the land ironclads. Land ironclads, which I think is brigade models.
Could be brigade.
Yeah, I think they're 1/900th or 1/12th. Yeah, 1200th. Big things like that. Because the units, I think, are like 2 millimeter figures or something like that. You know, casted blocks with, guys and writers. Yeah.
And
things.
And it's hard for me to go much below 15s and without my mind wandering.
Yeah.
You know, a friend of mine calls Mike Romer wargaming in Braille. There's just little bumps that I feel to see there.
When you see my 2 millimeter volume bayonet.
I've seen some really cool 2 millimeter volume bayonet stuff. I've seen one guy that did it all on clear bases.
Uh huh.
So that when you put the base on the board,
yep,
all
disappear.
You saw was the soldiers and then the terrain underneath.
Yeah, but you won't find some of them.
Yeah, tough with the skirmishers.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
of course, he wasn't doing a reduced scale. He was doing, so he had 3-inch bases.
Oh, God.
You know, big 3-inch clear bases with, brigades formed on them. So you saw them. And they really looked like brigades.
Yeah.
Really nice.
Yeah. I've seen them do, like, just a blue or green stripe on one side to help you.
Mm-hmm.
So things just don't disappear.
I found that with camouflage micro armor that really works. You know, you'll lose a platoon in that bunch of lichen over there.
Oh yeah, especially like if you're doing 1940 and you do French armor, because their stuff has got, we were playing an East Front 44 game at one point and discovered a Somwa hiding in the woods.
Yeah.
That's a surprise.
So what do you, any of you read steampunk?
Yep.
What do you read? Who do you like?
Right now I'm enjoying the hell out of Spring-Heeled Jack.
Yeah?
Yeah. Generally I've been reading light stuff.
That's Mike Resnick?
I believe so.
I think it's Mike Resnick, yeah.
But that and light, pretty much light stuff. Mm-hmm. Nothing really dense.
Anybody else?
You guys can't see this. This is a secret.
Oh, well, this good is, way to hide it.
This is exactly
a clear box.
This is exactly it.
This is the offering.
Right. Look. Ooh. Oh, you guys. These are the things for tonight's game.
Ooh.
Nice. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Very nice.
Anyway, so Frank is, everyone knows that Frank's running Space 1889. What time for
yes.
that?
Yes.
Seven.
This goes from 4 to 5:30, and then it's I think it's
7.
7 o'clock, right?
7.
Oh, it's on my badge.
Yeah. There we go.
Yes, 7.
So it gives you time to have dinner and then do the game. There you go. Well, there you are.
Well, dinner is mostly going to be taken up with doing the stat sheet.
Oh, well, there you go. Yes.
Very nice. Very nice.
So any chance we'll see miniatures again for the Sky Galleons and Mars?
There's a chance of almost anything. I never want to say there's no chance. I'm not working on that actively right now. But the I get approached periodically by people who say, I'm kind of interested in doing this. And I say, well, let me know what you're thinking of doing. And then they you don't hear from them or there nothing happens. So. So right now, my main focus is the 15-millimeter line that Rod's doing at Highlander Studios. You can see it on, or you can find it, you can search for his blog, too, Highlander Studios. But in my blog or his blog, you can see a lot of the masters of this, man, really good stuff. I mean, I'm not just saying that because, I mean, I'm not saying it just because I'm doing it. Now, I would say it. But that's not why. It really is good stuff. And you can see for yourself. You can see for yourself how good it is.
So how do you feel about taking steampunk out of the Victorian setting and throwing it in fantasy settings and sci-fi settings?
Well, that's the big thing right now is bringing fantasy. It's not so much. My impression is it's not so much bringing fantasy into the steampunk setting. It's that a whole bunch of fantasy authors have decided that they want to bring some steampunk stuff into their work.
Hasn't that been around for a while? There's that whole Wizard Engineer series.
Yeah, it has been a while. I don't mean that it's just happening now. But it's it has been around for a while. But there's a people are finally realizing that that Tolkien was not the only gateway to fantasy. Tolkien and Howard were not the only gateways to fantasy. That it doesn't have to be a medieval world to be fantasy. You know, and actually some of this stuff goes back. Some of the oldest pre-named steampunk stuff that involves some magic as well as some very whimsical technology is, I don't remember any of you remember the old Esterhazy short stories that were a long time ago. There's a reference to them, a passing reference to them in Space 1889, because they were set in the Istrian Pannonian Trans-Balkanian Empire. And he was kind of a where the, they had, and Graustark and Ruritania were bordering states, and they were the and they had, you know, aerial vessels, and he was kind of the court wizard or something in this kind of early, you know, late, really kind of early first decade of the 19th century, of the 20th century, you know, early 1900s thing. Very, you know, very kind of quirky, whimsical stories that were. I forget who wrote them, but it was Esterhazy was the guy at the. Yeah, the Istrian Pannonian Trans-Balkanian Empire, which was not a very big or prosperous place, despite its long and impressive name.
What's the one, Clockwork and Chivalry? Is that the one that they're trying to bring in the RPG? Is that the...
That sounds like a crossover.
They're trying to bring in kind of technology, you know, weird technology.
And we talked about the John Carter of Mars. There's another one coming up, and that's the Three Musketeers. And I don't know if anybody's seen the stuff for the Three Musketeers, but it's definitely got a steampunk look to it.
Really?
But it's you know, of course it's not steam, but it's clockwork, gunpowder, punk, whatever that is. You know, I mean, and the Three Musketeers that they're working on, it looks like it's got some very interesting visual stuff in it. How do I feel about it? I don't like to pass judgment on, you know, well, this isn't real steampunk. I mean, this Jesus, you know, that kind of drives me crazy when people are trying to define it. It's a term that was originally invented as a joke, okay? The term steampunk is a joke, because it had the original Victorian science fiction had nothing to do with the punk ethic. But a couple guys said, we should ought to call it steampunk, and, you know, maybe somebody pay attention. And ta-da! the term has gotten traction, and now people are trying to go back and make people adhere to some sort of punk ethic within. It's steampunk. It's Victorian science fiction. I don't like the idea of people trying to explain what is and isn't real steampunk. You know,
there was actually a costume panel on what is and what is not steampunk. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Costume Nazi.
And I've read things on some of the steampunk blogs about what is not steampunk. Goggles are not steampunk. What do goggles have to do with steampunk? Goggles are cool. Some of my... That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And
the spark slide.
Yeah, it's a stinker thing, right?
The early trains wouldn't power trains. You had your mesh goggles to protect your eyes from centers. Yeah.
So yeah, there's lots of reasons why it is that. I mean, it's just people getting fussy, fussy and stupid. I think when they try to find an objective reason why their personal preferences and tastes are superior. Ought to be the standard against which everyone else is judged, you know.
To me that the Japanese have been throwing like steampunkish themes into video games and anime for decades now.
I mean, one of the great seminal things, which came out at almost the same time as Space 1889, it came out like a year or two before, but it wasn't in the U.S. at the time. It took a long, long time to get to the U.S. was Miyazaki's Laputa Castle in the Sky.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just this terrific, terrific. Those of you who haven't seen it, yeah, I highly recommend it. I think it's Miyazawa's. It's the first film Miyazawa, Ghibli Studio did. Ghibli Studio. That's how it's called, Ghibli Studio. But the man, is that a neat film? And
Elves and Nausicaa and all those.
And a lot of his
Steam
Boy. He did Steam Boy, which certainly has that. One of my personal favorites, which is not exactly steampunk, but it probably fits what some. It's really a pulp film, but it may be what some people are now starting to call diesel punk.
Yes.
But I was just telling Anne about this. Porco Rosso. Oh, great film. What a great film, Porco Rosso. You look like you're about to say, yeah.
I was agreeing.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know that scene where he's sort of drifting in, seeing all those planes going up to heaven?
Uh-huh.
That's a Roald Dahl short story.
Is it?
Yes.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Huh.
Another great example would be City of Lost Children.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that.
Okay. Yeah. The visualization is very, very steampunk. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought the term steampunk came about to indicate this new thing that was not cyberpunk, or cyberpunk.
Well, cyberpunk. It was a differentiation from cyberpunk, but there was a punk ethic to cyberpunk.
Definitely.
That I don't think is there with steampunk. It certainly wasn't at the time. That's why it was a joke term.
Right.
It was a joke. It was initially a joke term that now people are trying to impose. Since it's called this, it has to be like this, and it wasn't at the time, and it really isn't.
A lot of steampunk literature is really, there's a whole comedy of manners that's typical Victorian.
Exactly. And it's the opposite of punks.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Very much. The dystopic, desperate worldview of a lot of cyberpunk literature is notably absent from most steampunk stuff.
Because that's the era of progress.
Yes.
Expecting wonderful advancements from the technology.
But also, remember that a lot of the classic, the seed literature is about the dangers attendant to progress. That's certainly the message of
Frankenstein.
Was that Frankenstein?
Island of Dr. Moreau.
Island of Dr. Moreau. The Invisible Man. Food of the Gods.
20,000
Leagues Beneath the Sea. I'm not sure that. Well, in a sense, it is, because Nemo is certainly reacting against industry. And by the same token, you can also argue Master of the World and Rover the Conqueror. They're kind of the same thing. Maybe not quite as well executed. Well, clearer. Maybe not as well executed, because those didn't become the classics that 20,000 Leagues did. But yeah, there's always that undercurrent in the Victorian scientific romance, I think is what they called it, was of the dangers of the promise of progress and the dangers of progress. And I think that if there are things that are seemingly steampunk, that are at the heart of some sort of steampunk ethic, one of those is the irreconcilable conflict between security and progress. That progress is by nature fraught with some peril, and so you're always going to have forces that are afraid of the peril and will try to hold back progress. You'll always have forces who are so enamored of progress they will push forward regardless of the peril.
Yes.
And we'd all like to think that there is a perfect ground in there. But I don't know that there is. And so, I mean, that irreconcilable conflict is kind of, I think, a critical element that ought to be part of steampunk.
Yeah, where's my flying car?
where's my flying car? Yeah.
Don't look in the shop right now.
I wonder if that links cyberpunk to steampunk. Cyberpunk is this rapid progress into the future. People are trying to cling to the safety of the past. Whereas steampunk, in a way, seems to be these people clinging to the civility of the past. Clinging to the civility of the past while the future is intruding kind of a mirror in way of mirror image.
In some ways it is. I think it is. Cyberpunk, I think, though, is more about our worst fears realized. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, as opposed to this might or might not happen that causes all these. But in cyberpunk, I think instead of saying, you know, here's what might happen, you know, here it is, and it's really awful. You know, and how do we live in a world that has become really messed up by technology? To me, that's kind of what a lot of the cyberpunk stuff is about. Worlds that really were poisoned by technology, and people poisoned by technology. The loss of humanity because of modification of the body and stuff like that. The steampunk, I think that tension is important. With the possibility that progress will still deliver, but also the possibility that it'll cause some real problems. Another aspect I think that's important in steampunk, at least that I appreciate, is this notion that technological progress is extremely upsetting to the established social order, mm-hmm. because it changes the social order, and it changes the economic patterns of the world, and economic and social patterns of the world in such a way that it inevitably undermines the existing social order and supports a new social order. And so there's that conflict and you see that very much in the kind of historically the passing of the old order that really kind of collapsed in World War I. But the whole period that a lot of steampunk takes place in sociologically is when the old order is still very much in control, but it's crumbling because of industry, and there's this enormous reaction against the rise of the organized working class. I mean, all these social things in Europe that are going on are kind of these things that are happening because you've got technology changing the way everything goes together. Yes?
Are you just thinking of a good reference point for steampunk? For this, what you're just saying would be Barbara Tubman's? The Proud Tower.
Yes.
Oh, possibly so, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yes, I'm reading it now.
I don't know which verse that's in.
It's a historic.
Yeah.
Starting from about 1880 to 1914.
Oh,
it goes like
her most famous book on the First World War is Guns and Roses.
The Guns and Roses. This is the prequel.
And she further explains what's happening.
It's broken into like the Grandees, which is the Victorian upper class, starting with Salisbury.
Yeah.
The anarchists, the French socialists, the Dreyfus.
Affair.
Socialist, the Dreyfus Affair, the disarmament conference called by the Tsar, and then the last one is just before the war was more of the socialists and the assassination of
Juarez in France. Yeah. Yes, that ends it. But the preface alone is a beautiful summary of what is happening right then, and it incorporates all the elements you just mentioned, where so many people, especially those of the upper class, are looking back on the era right before the First World War, and it's a long golden afternoon where everything is
the golden age.
It's splendid, and
the long golden afternoon of the aristocracy.
Of the aristocracy.
Long ugly night.
And she just takes that and pokes a big hole in it, and she said, "That's what none of them said that prior to the war. This is the memory afterwards."
Yeah. Yes.
So it's a wonderful book, and it actually moves pretty well, and it's not that hard to find.
It's an excellent book. She's a very good author, just in general.
Yeah, Tuckman is.
Are there any steampunk earlier than that, like Revolutionary War or Napoleonic Wars or anything?
What's that?
Faraday doesn't invent steam until.
You can say clockwork, but clockwork is as important to steampunk as steam is, probably.
And actually, the Romans and the Greeks are doing things with steam.
That's true.
Actually, I was thinking Ben Franklin and electricity and.
Well, there actually, there was in a sense a. This is one of my favorite shows that was. It's one of the, because it was one of it was at the time the most stupid show on television, and it's possibly the most stupid show in the history of television. And I loved it. Anybody remember Jack of All Trades?
Absolutely.
Revolutionary, well, Napoleonic War, steampunk. I mean, you know, she's got all sorts of steampunk stuff. She's got the diving submarine with that Ben Franklin helps her with. I mean, it's I don't know if any of you, some of you obviously have heard of Jack of All, but I love Jack of All Trades. It really is. But in a sense, that was Napoleonic era steampunk.
I remember Revolutionary War was when they were doing all the heat and steam experiments. That's your balloons.
Yeah.
Jefferson was smoking hot air.
And that's, I think that leads to another important aspect of steampunk. This was, for us, looking back, this was probably the last time that a self-educated person could change the world technologically.
That's true. Or a self-educated, or a single person working alone in a laboratory.
Right.
Yes.
It was also a time when the line between scientist and engineer was
yes.
It was still very blurry. Nikola Tesla, arguably one of the great. He's called one of the great scientists. He was really one of the great engineers of his day. He didn't really have the scientific background, but he had enormous intuitive and an intuitive grasp of a lot of science. But his background was really electrical engineering. He was a great electrical engineer, but he had some pretty screwy ideas about how things worked, and took them to his grave because he was kind of the last of that group of guys who were self-taught and. And when they went, I mean, I don't know how many know much about Nikola Tesla, but one of the things that he was remarkable for was he had literally a photographic ability to visualize, not just remember, but visualize. So he very seldom had working drawings of his stuff. He just built them, and he knew in his head how the parts fit together and how, you know, their measurements and dimensions and everything. And he could actually work from his head and build machines. And then later people kind of had to piece together some of the actual diagrammatic plans of them. But he mostly didn't work with plans and diagrams. He mostly worked from his head. I mean, really brilliant guy. Very strange guy. Very strange guy. All those early guys, like the Lord Kelvin, William Thompson, is as much engineer and tinkerer as he is brilliant physicist. And he, very interesting. Very interesting how that was kind of the last time that one guy sitting in one mad scientist in a laboratory could actually cook up stuff, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important too. I just picked up a wonderful old book called Up Funnel, Down Screw, which is about the struggle the British Navy had accepting mechanics and engineers. And engineers were really, really looked down upon. They were not accepted as officers. They were considered mechanics. Mm-hmm. And it took a very long time for the military to accept these people who worked with machines.
Well, as the British Army had a hard time accepting ordnance officers as officers, you know, as anything more than what is it, George MacDonald Fraser through the lips of Flashman says, after all, powder monkey's a powder monkey, ain't he? He's got the attitude towards these guys. So where were we in this? I discovered that the Q&A period had ended up being one long diversion, which is okay, as long as it takes places that we want to go.
I don't remember where we were, but I know where I want to go. Why do you think steampunk blew up the way it did in the 90s?
That's a good question, because and it's a really good question. I don't really know, but I'll tell you some things that I think are kind of interesting relating to that. When Space 1889 first came out, it enjoyed modest success. You know, modest success, nothing more than that. It was never a big smash hit. And, you know, we did a lot of support for it, and, you know, loved it and coddled it, and the people who liked it really, really liked it. And then there were a lot of the people that looked at it and just, they were just blank, you know. like a dog looking at a television set or something. I just don't understand what's going on here. And a retailer said to me, he says, the problem with Space 1889 is Space 1889 players are born, not made. You either either look at it and you get it, or you don't. And if you don't, you're never going to get it. Because recently I was interviewed by Andy Frankenmalen, the editor of the Untreated Green series, for an online thing, promotion thing. And we got talking about my route, you know, what took me to steampunk? You know, what brought me to steampunk? What interested me originally in it? And there are, I identified three themes, and I'll talk about it in a minute if you like. It might be maybe something kind of interesting to talk about. But the thing is, all of them were film. I mean, sure, I read some stuff, but there were film influences that really got me, that kind of came together to make all this stuff for Space 1889 work for me. And they were all films of a time when I was a youngster or an adolescent watching, and there was a period when there just weren't any films like that. So, you know, kind of people of my age and a little older got it, and a lot of people younger than that didn't get it. Now, I don't know why, but and maybe it was the retro movement. You know, the retro movement that kind of brought back the 60s stuff, and then swing in the 40s, eventually kind of got back to looking at the Victorian Edwardian stuff too. And although we call it Victorian science fiction because that's when a lot of it was written, I think the sensibility in a lot of ways is as Edwardian as it is Victorian. So that's not a real complete answer because I don't really have an answer as to why in that particular time it took off. But it's a different world now than it was then, because now Space 1889 players aren't just born. I mean, there's a growing number of people who get it, who look at it and get it. I will say this, that one thing that I learned over the course of my career in designing role-playing games is that role-playing games never really make a genre work. And the problem with Space 1889 is it was trying to present a genre that really didn't exist outside the game. That role-playing games really succeed when there is a genre already in place that people are intimately familiar with and they like it so much, they want a way to interact with it more. Right? And the game gives them that mechanism. It gives them a gateway to that genre that they already know. Whether it's westerns or fantasy or science fiction, but it's all these things that have usually have a lot of film support, but it can be literary support as well. And if people get the genre, then they want a way into it, and that's what the role-playing game provides them. And at Space 1889, we were kind of, here's the genre too. What do you think? And the people that, and in that sense, the people that already got it, already understood the genre, were ready to go. But if you didn't already understand the genre, and that's true of any role-playing game, but there was nothing outside of the game to, you know, to get people into it. And now there's all this stuff, for whatever reason, that's out there getting people excited about the genre. There now really is a genre. And Space 1889 is just a mechanism for interacting with it. And so I think that's kind of a big help. Yes?
You said there were three movies? What were they?
No, there's three strands, I would say. The first strand was movies that talked about the British colonial experience, usually from a military point of view. Zulu, sure, but the Four Feathers, Lives of a Bengal Lancer, King of the Khyber Rifles, Gunga Din, Khartoum. These are great, great films, I think. And so that, you know, there's that whole feel. The British colonial military experience. The second thread was the actual, in the late 50s and early 60s, a whole string of actual Victorian science fiction films. Because there was there were film versions of From the Earth to the Moon, Around the World in 80 Days, 5 Weeks in a Balloon, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, The Time Machine, Mysterious Island, off. Somebody may have done Off on a Comet, but the I was thinking Mysterious Island, but and The Wonderful World of Jules Verne, that amazing Hungarian film, or was it Hungarian, or I think so. This combination of animation and live action, it all looked like moving lithographs. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that film, the Amazing World of Jules Verne, but very, very interesting film. All those films kind of, First Man on the Moon was another one, First Man on the Moon. The Invisible Man. I don't include in that War of the Worlds, because the 50s version of War of the Worlds didn't work for me because it wasn't Victorian setting. All those others had kept the Victorian setting. They tried to set it in the 50s with flying Martian hovering ships with force fields, and that just didn't work. You know, they needed to be 18-pounders and Maxim guns and steam-powered ironclad rams. You know, that's what the War of the Worlds was about. But that's the second kind of strain of films that influenced me. And the third strain were the Hammer horror films.
Yeah.
Particularly the Frankenstein films with Peter Cushing were a different look at horror and mad scientists. And for one thing, although by today's standards they're very tame, they were very sexy back in the 60s, you know. For an adolescent, they really hit a nerve there, you know. Hot women what's that?
Women in corsets.
In corsets, that's right. You know, not bad. You know, I mean, everybody said, "Oh, the Victorian era was such, you know, asexual, prudish, blah blah blah." Then how come they invented the standard of dirty ladies' underwear that persists to this day? They didn't have any understanding of sexuality. You know, naughty underwear. You know, but anyway, but also Peter Cushing as Frankenstein played the part differently than a lot of people had played mad scientists up until then. Instead of the wild-eyed, maniacal, sadistic guy, Peter Cushing played Frankenstein as the most logical, sensible person in the film. Everybody else were the hysterical idiots. He was this icy, calm, sensible person, at least by his own lights. Now, he was still doing crazy stuff. But he was not this. He was not a maniac. He was just really smart and really focused. And no matter how weak the material, Cushing always respected the material. Okay, always respected the material, and that elevated the sense of willing suspension of disbelief, I think, for an audience enormously. Cushing could always sell it because you always got the sense he believed it. He could say the most absurd lines and. And you believed he believed what he was saying, you know. He was there. So those things, you know, their look at that science and the lone scientist, and you know, the possible evils and pitfalls and adventures associated with it, I think, were a really important strain to me. And then you add in a little bit of Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, because flying ships are just way cool. And but those are the three mainstays. But then I would say Edgar Rice Burroughs. I mean, I read the Barsoom stuff when I was a kid. You got to have some flying ships, even though those ships I have aren't like Burroughs' flying ships. They're still flying ships, and because flying ships are just too cool not to have. And the Wizard of Oz, flying monkeys. You know, you got to have flying monkeys, and that's the High Martians, right? The High Martians are basically the flying monkeys from the Wizard of Oz. As a little kid, that was one of the most frightening scenes.
Yes.
Hordes of flying monkeys coming after them. And it must have left an impression, because ever since that, that's just so cool. You just kind of got to have creatures like that. But those were the things that brought me to steampunk, and really were also the inspirations for Space 1889.
Cool. Thank you.
Oh, okay.